By way of introduction, I am Jennifer Tryon, a young leader and the Assistant Director of Pharmacy at PCell Southwest Medical Center in Vancouver, Washington. The purpose of the conversation today is to learn from the experiences of a successful leader and to gain insight into how to become more influential. It is my pleasure to introduce Sarah White. Sarah received her pharmacy degree from Oregon State University and then completed a two-year residency and received her master's from The Ohio State University. Sarah was the Associate Director of Pharmacy and Professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center and then was the Director of Pharmacy at Stanford. In retirement, Sarah is a pharmacy leadership coach. Welcome, Sarah. Sarah, you are well known for your involvement with leadership and developing leadership skills in others. Have you always been interested in leadership?
You know, it's a great question because I think it gets at how do you find your passion within pharmacy. And clearly, I didn't have any idea about leadership when I started out. I was intrigued in high school. For some reason, I read biographies rather than novels. And I remember reading about Thomas Edison and other great inventors and the impact they had. And whether that stuck with me or not, I'm not really sure. But the best decision I ever made was to go do a residency, and I did that at Ohio State because I saw a very innovative department making changes, and I saw the effect that leaders could really have. And so when I went to the University of Kansas, it was mainly a position for education, but I asked to have some administrative responsibilities. And they were just at the point that they were beginning to design and implement unit dose. And so I did that. So I think what one does over time is sort of discover your passion or discover your mission, and then you play to that. And so obviously then I went on in more administrative positions and then chose to be a director of pharmacy. So I think it's an excellent question for the audience to think about how you discover your passion.
Who have been your heroes and role models in leadership?
I've got some specific people I'll talk about, but first, I really want to acknowledge the staff and leadership team that I've had the pleasure to work with, because they've certainly taught me a lot throughout my career. But the four people I'll mention is certainly first Clifton Lachelet, who was the director of pharmacy and the residency director at Ohio State. And what I remember about Cliff is he always was doing things in the patient's best interest rather than his own glory. And I also was there at the point in time that he was the APHA president. He had already been ASHP president. So that concept that one could be involved in professional organizations and be involved at a national level. He would be the first one. Harold Godwin, who I had the pleasure to work with for 20 years at the University of Kansas Medical Center, learned a lot from Harold about how to function within an organization, both an academic medical center that has its set of politics and certainly a school of pharmacy, because we did both the teaching and the academic center. And Harold was great at figuring out how to get things done within an organization. And just one brief example, when we wanted to implement clinical services, we knew we didn't want to ever formally ask the medical staff for that permission, and the reason was we had a very strong, in fact, nationally recognized clinical pharmacologist on the medical staff. He would never have allowed us to do that. So what we basically did was take our unit dose positions, move our pharmacists to the units, and had them start doing clinical, and never really fully justified it. So there's always a way to do what you want to do. And the third one is a gal, Gloria Niemeyer Franke, who was a pioneer as a woman pharmacist. And I remember her telling me that when she first got out of pharmacy school, she applied for a position and got a letter back saying, "We do not hire women pharmacists." And she was a spunky gal, and she went on to be very influential in the profession and was instrumental basically in developing what we now call international pharmaceutical abstracts, and was the first executive secretary before Joe Otis for ASHP. So, you know, being successful as a woman was a good role model from her. And I think the last one I'll list is Joe Otis. I had the pleasure of being on the ASHP board and serving with him and watching again. Joe had such integrity and such what's the right thing to do. And in his case, it was what's the right thing to do for the profession. And you learn a lot from observing successful people. And I think that's a message to our audience. Watch successful people, even if it's things that they don't do that you don't like, don't do those, but make sure you observe and pick up because you're evolving your own skill set. So heroes and things are very important to think about.
With so much leadership potential, you could have chosen any career path. Why did you choose to pursue a career in pharmacy?
You know, to just give some perspective, I grew up in a very small town in northeastern Oregon. It was a population of a little over 1,000. And so I don't know that I knew much about pharmacy. I was kind of fascinated in high school with science. And I think some of that may have come from the fact that my mother was a diploma nurse. Both of my folks were in the Second World War. And I was born in 1945, right at the end of the Second World War. And I remember my mother talking about she had been stationed as an Army nurse at the Presidio in San Francisco. And she talked about giving this wonder drug as an investigational injection. And what it turned out to be was penicillin. And she said before that, we only had the sulfa drugs. And so in my lifetime, from being born in 45 to now, all of the medications that have actually come about, and what a wonder drug that was. And I think that science concept, and neither of my folks had gone to college. She was a diploma nurse. And so the concept, if I had stayed in one of the sciences, I would need a master's or a PhD. And it was a big deal just to go to college. So I think she probably suggested pharmacy as a good career for a woman who might have children and get married. Neither of those two things I actually did, but I've loved pharmacy. I love the physical and the biological sciences. And I love that we've got so many options of things we can do. At that point in time, I had no idea I would gravitate towards administration and leadership. But I think just the fascination in pharmacy. And it's always neat to ask people sort of their story because everybody has a different story of how they got into pharmacy.
What have been the greatest influences in your career?
You know, again, I think that's a great question. It made me think about what have those been. I think early on for me it was having opportunities because at my first position, I had actually worked a couple of years getting out of school and was kind of bored with practice. And a friend and I went to Europe for a summer, and then people had mentioned these residency programs. And once I came out of the residency, there were lots of opportunities. And I was, I guess, naive enough maybe to jump at those. And those were things like speaking around the country. At that point in time, in kind of the early 70s, we were evolving IV admixture programs. And so there was a whole series of seminars that a number of us presented teaching pharmacists how to make IV admixtures because we didn't ever learn that in school. And so being able to speak, getting confidence doing that, teaching, because I had both undergraduate students, we had a residency program at Kansas, were great opportunities because you learn as much doing those as the students learn. And lastly, I guess, just the fact in a tenure track faculty position, which I was in at Kansas because we wanted to make sure we could vote on the curriculum, and you could only do that if you're tenure track, I needed to publish or I would perish. In the academic world, you either get promoted to an associate professor or you're finding another job, basically. And so that stimulated me to do a lot of publishing. And where that has paid off for me down the road is not only the confidence and the ability to do those things, but then as I kind of approached retirement and people suggested when I had called Henry Manassi, the exec of ASHP, and said, you know, I'm thinking about retiring. He said, why don't you think about coming to Washington, D.C., spending 3 or 4 months and doing what we call a scholar in residence. And basically what you do is study some topic and then publish on it. And so I did that. And what I looked at was what's the status in health system pharmacy of leadership. Did some surveys and found interesting data that then I was able to publish that we are potentially having a leadership crisis because I found that of the current directors as of data in 2004, approximately 80% of them, because they were getting close to retirement age, were not anticipating continuing in their positions for the next 10 years. And I think the surprising aspect is that's not necessarily, I mean, you just expect that to happen, was that the current practitioners, we only had about 30% that would even consider moving into those positions. And so what that sort of did was rekindle, if you will, the interest in leadership and leadership training. And for me personally, I've gotten a lot of speaking engagements from doing that. So having the skill set, the confidence to do those things, and then I knew how to publish, and some other things that I've done recently that I've always wanted to do is publish a series on what I call success skills, how to be successful as a pharmacist, and was able to do that because I'd had some publishing experience. So I think all of it lends itself well. So I guess to sum it up, you know, seek out opportunities, volunteer for opportunities, and then as you get some experience, make those opportunities. You know, a good example of making the opportunity is the recently published book by ASHP that's called The Pharmacy Leadership Field Guide that you helped me edit along with Mike DeCoxey. And we were able to design a book, a very case-based approach, very practical, and have new practitioners write the cases and then a veteran mentor give advice. And so those are, again, making opportunities as well as seizing those.
The recording of the conversations, like the one that you and I are having here, is a concept that you thought up and developed. What was the purpose and the background for why you developed the conversations, and how do you see these being used by pharmacists?
Well, let me give you a little background. When I first, I think the first mid-year clinical meeting that I went to, there were like 300 people. And now, as our audience knows, it's like 20,000 plus. And so it was much easier as a younger practitioner to meet the current leaders, the influential people, and get to know them and benefit from their expertise. And what I found over the last few years in mentoring young folks is it's very difficult for them to get to know people. And so I thought, what if we had these recorded conversations? And so that twofold, you could learn from the experience that the person has had. You could also see their personality and get to know them a little bit so that if you did see them at a meeting, you wouldn't hesitate to go up and talk to them. And so we have, I think, about 12 to 15 of these recorded. And I see them used for, you know, any kind of practitioners. We have posted an hour-long conversation, and then we've cut it into two parts. There's part A and part B if you want to do it with students or your staff or residents and have a discussion and see what points they pick up and as a learning experience for them. So our plans are to continue to add more people as influential leaders in health system as, again, a way to bridge sort of the expertise with the younger practitioners.
As a seasoned veteran, you have undoubtedly seen many changes over time in pharmacy and in healthcare. What was pharmacy practice like when you entered the profession as a new pharmacist, and how have you seen it evolve?
Well, and again, remember, I'm graduating in 1968, and it's interesting because what we role-played and practiced in pharmacy school was how to not tell a patient the name of their drug if they ask us, because that was still the purview of the physician. So basically, in a health system or in a hospital at that point in time, the nurses on any unit had a number of stock bottles of medications. And so what pharmacy service was, they would send down their empty bottles in kind of a little basket tray. And so what we were doing as pharmacists was just filling the bottle back up, and it would go up to the nursing unit. We didn't see physicians' orders, and so we were astute enough to realize that we were asking nurses to do things that were really not their training nor their interest. And so the first thing that evolved was we need to see a copy of the physician's order. And so we just merely put an NCR sheet behind the physician order form, and then it was torn off and sent down to pharmacy. Then what we decided is that we needed to provide more patient-identified medication. So we developed a system that was called an individual patient prescription. So if, for example, the order came down and you were to receive a drug for four times a day, the average length of stay at that point was 5 days, believe it or not. So we would send up 20 labeled for you. So then what the nurse had were your medications, small quantities, labeled on the unit. So that was kind of that evolution. About that point in time, we started thinking about IV admixture programs. I do remember in my first hospital, a nurse calling, and at that point, they would have the ampules and vials for injectables on their unit. And she called and she said, you know, I had this clear vial, and the way they would administer is put it in what's called a Buretrol, an inline chamber. And she said, when I injected that in, it got all white and cloudy. Is there a problem? And of course, we couldn't expect her to understand the physical compatibilities or incompatibilities. So we set about designing IV admixture programs. And we had to make our own mini bags at that point in time because there was no, those were not made. And then we began to say, okay, how are we going to label these? We don't want to have to label them individually. So somebody found, and technology starts early on, a Selectric typewriter that you could program a card. And so you would have the drug name and the frequency, and then you would just add the patient name in and then run off the labels you needed for the next 24 hours. And so as we did that, we thought, well, Neil, that isn't really a pharmacist's role. Can we use some, you know, secretaries or what became pharmacy technicians to actually make all those labels, deliver, get the orders back and forth? And so we evolved the IV admixture program concept. And then we began to look at medication errors and realized that even in the individual patient prescription system, we were still having errors being made. And so people began to experiment with what became unit dose of setting up the medications for each of the major medication pastimes. So we literally, in the beginning with unit dose, you delivered four card exchanges, drawer labeled for the patient, only those doses that were needed in that time frame. And so that evolved the unit dose concept. And along the way, we realized that we were getting, at that point, I did a 5-year college degree for a baccalaureate, that we knew a lot about medications. And so why weren't we up there with the physicians helping in the prescribing decision process? And that was the clinical pharmacy of moving into. I had gotten to read one patient chart in college and had not really gone to see patients or been on rounds. And so then we've evolved it into computerizing our operations for both our billing and our labeling, and evolved the clinical. And then now, of course, we have automation that puts the medications on the nursing unit. And before I left Stanford, it's interesting, when I went to Stanford Hospital and Clinics in 1992, they were still a manual pharmacy system and transcribing on profiles. And so we computerized it. We then automated, so we weren't filling unit dose carts anymore. And then we implemented a computerized physician order entry system where the physicians actually wrote the orders. So it's kind of come from, in my career, basically from having gone through pharmacy school on a slide rule to all of this computerization. But interestingly enough, you learn that as you go. So don't ever fear what's coming up. You can learn it when you need to figure it out. So we've, my generation at least, has evolved practice to this point. The challenge now for those of you viewing this video is, where are you going to continue to take practice? And that's your challenge, because it needs to continue to evolve and make the best use of the pharmacist's time and ensure patient safety.
What was it like being a woman when you entered pharmacy as your profession, and how have you seen that change over time?
And that's really also, again, it's going to be the, you know, the late 60s. In terms of society at that point, women, there were much more defined roles for a woman and a man. You rarely, if ever, and I don't think you ever saw a male flight attendant or a rare male elementary school teacher. And it was the same kind of thing in with women in pharmacy, in that ASHP was formed in 1942. And if you look at the founding members, about half were women. But there wasn't a woman ASHP president until 1978. They were behind the scenes. They were secretaries, vice presidents, etc. And in my personal case, I shudder now, but I remember very vividly in high school being nominated for student body president and declining that because it should be a guy. And, you know, that's just was the way it was. I was vice president and things like that. So it's been nice that society has evolved that a man or a woman can do anything. And so there are very few women in my pharmacy class. But then we evolved it into where now it's about equal in the profession. And obviously there are many more women in pharmacy school than there are males. And other men can do a lot of different things. So it's just part of the societal evolution of things.
And what do you think are some of the greatest challenges facing pharmacy today? And what role does leadership play in helping us address those challenges?
Well, and interestingly enough, you know, everybody's talking about the doom and gloom because of healthcare reform. But if I think back in my career, early on, we could charge for anything. And if we needed to increase our services and cover our costs for FTEs, we just upped our drug charges. Well, then came what's called DRGs, and that was doom and gloom because it was a capitated system. And what it meant is we just had to figure out how to justify our services in a different way. And so it's that same kind of time now. Use the changes as a fantastic opportunity to, again, maximize the use of pharmacists. And it goes into how is our practice model set up. And our practice model is basically how we deploy our resources, where we work, how we work, what are we doing. And we need to continue to evolve that into whatever the next future is going to be. So I think we've got to be willing to take some calculated risks, like those first pharmacists who went up and went on rounds were pretty courageous because they knew they spent a lot of time trying to learn the patients because they knew they were going to be put on the spot with questions. But if they hadn't taken those first steps, we wouldn't be near where we are as a profession now. So whatever those next steps are, we need to be willing to do that. And there's a current initiative, the PPMI, the Pharmacy Practice Model Initiative, that we're underway about how should we, again, allocate our resources. And so I think we need to continue this service evolution on behalf of our patients and our colleagues.
You've had a very successful career as a leader, the associate director and professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center, director of pharmacy at Stanford, a past president for ASHP, and a Whitney Award winner. What, in your opinion, are the keys to a successful leader?
Well, let's talk about it really in two phases, a successful pharmacist, and then let me add in the successful leader. I think a successful pharmacist needs to, first and foremost, be the CEO, the chief executive officer of their career, meaning that you take responsibility for how your career is evolving. You don't fall into a victim. If you're unhappy, make the changes that need to be made. And along with that, then, is defining for yourself your practice vision. What's the ideal way you want to practice? And set that as a goal and try to work towards it. Because having goals and working towards them will keep you in a positive attitude, and you need to, along the way, build relationships. I wish I'd understood earlier on the power of the relationships. And what I'm talking about are not only the people you work with in the pharmacy, but those that you interface with throughout the organization. And a relationship is knowing somebody well enough to know what their interests are, knowing your own interests, and knowing a little bit about each other personally, so that you're reacting as Sarah and Jennifer, not, you know, a role to a role. Because then you are looking in a cooperative fashion to what's the best for our patients. So relationships are key. Also, I think a key to success is being willing to persist, because you're always going to run into obstacles. You're going to run into people saying you can't do something. And you've got to figure out a way to move around that. And if your goals are significant enough, then move towards them. And what that does is build your own self-confidence and self-belief. I mean, we all got through pharmacy school, which is not an easy endeavor. So you can do whatever you set your mind to doing. And I think the last one that I'll talk about for all pharmacists is really continue to grow and develop. Seek opportunities. Ask if you can be on committees or you can speak. Get outside your comfort zone a little bit because that will grow your expertise. And realize that all of these skill sets you're going to use in the other aspects of your life, whether you coach a little league team or you participate in your church or your community. So you're not learning these things just in your work. And now let me add in, if you're a leader, and what a new leader ought to think about. And all of the things I've just talked about are important. But I think as a formal leader, you want to first and again foremost, partner with your boss. Understand what they're trying to achieve, which means you'll understand what the organization needs to have done. And work together with what's the best use of our time and efforts together. And I think for a new leader, a real key is actual experience. You can read the books, you can understand how to terminate someone, fire someone, but until you do it yourself, you really don't have a good understanding of that. So seek out those uncomfortable experiences to continue to grow with actual experience and take advantage of all of the resources that are available. In ASHP, there's the Pharmacy Leadership Academy, which we'll talk about in a minute. There's a Leadership Resource Center, all of which you can find on the ASHP Foundation page. These conversations, there are many of those. So continue to grow and develop. And then I think lastly is a give back concept. And this would be for all pharmacists as well. Be willing to publish and share your results. Be willing to speak at state, local, and national meetings and share what you're doing. Be willing to mentor people. We'll talk about that in a little more detail in a minute. But give back because people have helped you, so be willing to do that because you learn a lot in that process. So those are just a few. There are many, but those are a few of what I would say success skills are.
Sarah, you have mentored many leaders in pharmacy. What is the significance of mentorship in a career?
I think this is a key question because I don't know that I understood this early on. Certainly when you do a residency, your preceptors mentor you. And certainly Cliff Lachelet, every time he saw it at meetings, he would always say, what are you doing about this? What are you doing about that? But let me step back and say that I think to be successful, every pharmacist and every pharmacy student must have a mentor. And what a mentor is to me is someone who is doing or has done what you would like to do. So you probably have a mentor or two in your professional life, but also look at, if you're a younger professional, people who are successfully balancing a career and a family, and how do they do that? So you may have several mentors. And what you're going to do with a mentor is share your experiences. And they're not going to solve your problems, but they're going to stimulate you with questions to think about how to do things. And they're also going to open up their networks, introduce you to people, coach you if the first time you speak or publish what to expect, and help you be successful. And what you're learning is all of the street smarts, if you will, the hard knocks. You're still going to make some of your own, but you can benefit from an experienced veteran. And all you have to do is ask somebody to be your mentor, because we can't read your minds, and you need to take responsibility as the mentee of letting us know what your needs are. And it doesn't have to be somebody you work with. I mentor people around the country, either over email, over the phone. You can have a relationship and see people at meetings. So benefit from other people's experience. And don't be afraid to ask us. It's really a compliment if somebody wants to have my expertise. So use mentors to benefit your career.
Switching gears just a little bit, as a faculty member of the Pharmacy Leadership Academy, the PLA, which is an ASHP Foundation totally online curriculum and program for new and aspiring leaders, You've presented and developed the concept and the module of leading yourself. What does it mean to lead yourself?
And this is material that I wish I had learned earlier on too. Leading yourself simply means handling yourself so others want to work with you. So what does that mean? It really means handling the normal human emotions that we all have, the anger, the fear, the worry, in a constructive way. And I think the best thing I've ever read and always talk about is the Stephen Covey pause. You know, it takes two to have an argument. So if somebody's yelling at you, your best bet is to pause momentarily and think about what's my best response here versus just automatically yelling back. And so that ability to control yourself a little bit, I think, is very handy. So we cover that material. We also deal with an area that I hadn't been introduced to for a long time, and it's called self-talk. It's this internal dialogue that we all have with ourselves. And a good example is when you're driving home each night from work, are you reviewing in your mind the things that went right? Or are you like most of us and you review the one or two things that didn't go right, or you the wouldas, shouldas, coulda situation? So how do you modify that self-talk to really have a positive attitude and look for opportunities in things rather than the poor me, woe is me concept? So we deal with those aspects. We deal with sort of a philosophy, if you will, of how do you approach your career and your life together? Because you shouldn't really try to separate them. And so things like thinking about, as a young person, you're going to work several decades in your career, that you don't have to do everything in the first few years out. You can really look at your career as what I call a marathon, that you want to finish strong, but you want to finish, versus a sprint where you do everything the first few years. And an example is, even as a young person, I was this way. You want to do everything. You want to, you know, have young children, have a new job, and be state chapter president. You can do it all. You're not going to enjoy it all, and you're going to want to do it in a different way. So just stage your career out so you can enjoy each piece of it along the way. So that whole philosophy of how to work with yourself, I think, is a key, and that's what we cover in this Leading Yourself module.
You've often given the advice of do what makes sense to you. It's simple advice, but that can be very difficult to implement. What prevents pharmacists from listening to those instincts and pushing beyond barriers to do what makes sense to them?
Well, and I think as I've reflected on things in my career, a lot of it comes from our scientific training. And in school, there is a right and wrong answer. And that continues in the drug therapy world. But as you think about even providing your professional services, you're going to make a different decision at 3 a.m. in the morning than you may make at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning. And so as a professional, what we've got to do is adjust for the circumstances and adapt to what's different in the particular situation. And certainly we don't want to take risks with drug therapy. But let me contrast that with how we organize and process our work, where we work. We can take calculated risks there because we're not going to harm a patient. We're going to learn from that and move forward. Again, the first folks that did anticoag clinics had to experiment with how's the best way to organize themselves, how's the best way to use a pharmacy technician, as an example. So I think it's being flexible and adjusting and recognizing that there's not one right answer to any of these things. And that, you know, comes from the pharmacy school, a benzene ring's a benzene ring, and so it's not going to change. So I think just being sensitive to what makes the best sense. A personal quick example is right after 9/11, a number of my managers were out traveling. So I was kind of there by myself, and the day after we had a bomb scare in the hospital, and we needed to evacuate the pharmacy. And that's nothing anybody ever teaches you to do. And so I had to think about what drugs do we take and how do we do it. And so then it's what makes the most sense. We grabbed some of our crash cart boxes and I said, get these out. And, you know, you do what makes sense at that point in time. And just trust your instincts, as you mentioned, because you've got the knowledge base and somebody's got to make a decision. And that's why you're a professional.
Perhaps one of the most frequently discussed leadership concepts that you have coined and developed is that of the Big L, Little L leader. Can you describe for us what is Big L leadership and what is Little L leadership?
Okay, let me start with the Big L leaders. And these are the people that you typically think about because they are the ones that have what we think of as leadership titles, a director, a store manager, a clinical coordinator, an ops manager, for example. So these are the folks that you think about. The little L leader, though, is really every pharmacist on their shift or in their practice. Because as I traced through the evolution of pharmacy services in my career, it wasn't just the leaders, it was every pharmacist that made all of those systems work. And what we need to have being happening going forward is that every pharmacist is thinking about where can I evolve my shift or my practice to do more for patients? And we need everybody involved in that. So there really are two aspects of leadership, the big L and the little L. Another key, as I found, as I mentioned earlier with my survey on leadership, we need more of the average pharmacist to be willing to step up to these leadership roles. Because if when a director position or any of the others become vacant, if we can't find a pharmacist, the organization has to hire somebody, a non-pharmacist. And is that in the best interest of our patients or of our staff? I don't think so. So every pharmacist ought to think of themselves as a little L leader. In fact, ASHP this past year has now a statement identifying those roles for every pharmacist as a little L leader.
With regard to career planning, you've talked about legacies and careers. What does it mean to leave a legacy?
That's an interesting word, isn't it? Because you tend to think about that, or I always kind of thought about it, as sort of, you know, at the end of your career or maybe at your funeral. But as I've reflected on a legacy, it really is how people are going to remember you. How are the people that you've worked with, your children, your students, how are they going to remember what you are all about? And what are they going to talk about when you're gone, whether you've left the position or whether you've, you know, passed on, so to speak. And I think the key is for all of us to realize that we're creating our legacy every day with every interaction we have, because that's how people recognize who you are and what you stand for. And that goes back to that leading yourself and being a little conscious of how often you blow up and how often you irritate people. But a legacy really is, what's your impact? What do you want to have the difference make for you being here and being a pharmacist? And giving a little thought to that early in your career, because you really are creating that. And so you ought to stop at this moment and think about, if I were to leave, what would the people say? And is it what I want them to say? Would they say, gee, I'm going to miss Jennifer, or don't have to work with her again? And, you know, you may not like the aunt, but you need to think about it because you're consciously making those interactions. So choose the way in which you're going to leave a legacy. And don't wait until the end for somebody else to really think of that. Is it the way you want to, and is it a battle worth fighting? And, you know, because you can win a battle and lose the war, as they say. And so think about whether burning that relationship, and this really comes into play with relationships, because it takes a while to develop a good relationship with somebody, but boy, can you destroy it very quickly. And it's very hard to rebuild that. So again, that pause, is this the best way to handle this before I just shoot my mouth off? And if you do make a mistake, which all of us do, and blow up, then just go back and apologize. Nobody expects you to be perfect. They do expect you to take responsibility for your actions. And I think in the email world, be very careful. If you're irritated when you write an email, don't send it. Wait 24 hours, and it'll look totally different, and you'll be happy you didn't fire that off. And the same way, you know when you're about to blow. And so walk away and say, let's talk about this later, or let me get back to you later, unless it is something that has to have a decision now. And that's, again, that leading yourself of being in control enough that people want to work with you.
Sarah, what do you think your legacy has been?
Well, I think any person is really too close to know their own true legacy. But let me tell you what I hope it is. I hope it is that the people I've come in contact with, I've helped them move towards their potential, achieve their greatness. I hope I'm seen as having helped the evolution of our pharmacy services from, you know, what I began in the pharmacy with to what we have now. I think lately I've renewed the interest in leadership training. I've certainly had the pleasure of working with over 100 residents in my career, which has really been a pleasure. So I think it's the people relationships. That's what I missed a lot when I retired, was most of the people. There are some that, as all of us, would not wish to continue that relationship. But I think that has been the fun part of my legacy. And again, I'm going to be too close to ever know what that is. I will tell you one story, though, that's kind of interesting, I think, that illustrates a little bit about this legacy issue. Several years ago, I was speaking at the Florida Society. And after my talk, this pharmacist came up and he said, "I really want to thank you." And what he talked about was he was an architectural student at some point in the past at Kansas. And he was interested in pharmacy. And he said someone had suggested my name. So he called me at the med center and I spent 20 or 30 minutes on the phone. And I talked about pharmacy and what the answered his questions and et cetera. And he said that's the reason he went into pharmacy. And I obviously don't even remember that encounter. So that's an issue of always do the right thing for people. And that will help them and you. Because to him, it was the reason he went into pharmacy. And I thanked him for coming up and mentioning it because I had no recollection. It was one thing in a million things I probably did that day. But investing that small amount of time made so much difference to him. So always invest that credit in others.
As a leader, you have always been involved in state and national organizations, professional organizations. What has been the value to you and to your career of that involvement, of being involved in professional organizations?
Let me answer that and begin the answer, really, with what is a professional organization for us? Because as we think about, there are many things as an individual pharmacist that it would be very hard for us to do. And examples of that would be monitoring the legislation, even in our states, let alone at the federal level. Doing continuing education programs, having journals, etc. So what we do as individual pharmacists, by joining a professional organization, we pool our resources and we can hire then staff who do those functions on our behalf. And so that's what a professional organization is all about. And there are organizations, as we all know, at the local, state, and national level. And I think every pharmacist needs to belong to some of those organizations. The value to you personally, then, as a pharmacist, is the ability to go to meetings. And when you go to continuing education meetings, as we all have to keep our licenses up, don't always sit with the folks that you always sit with. Sit with new people, meet new people, build your professional network, because those will be beneficial to you later. And then seek out, volunteer to be on committees, volunteer to run for board of directors, presidential officers, because the skills you pick up in doing that are going to help you the rest of your career and your life. Yes, you give a little bit of your personal time, but the benefit to you, let alone to the profession, is far greater than any amount of time. And for me personally, it's how I developed leadership skills. It's the way I got to know a lot of folks across the country, that many of which now are personal friends and will be the rest of my life. So utilize professional organizations both to learn about things and to support the profession. So I think those are the things I would say about the value, really, of being involved in professional organizations. And all you've got to do is volunteer to be on committees at a local or state level, because they need people to help them do those functions.
Why should professionals get involved in doing more than what's required of them on their shift and in their daily routines?
Well, and I know people's lives are busy today, but you know, you spend a lot of time at work, and so you want it to be fun, you want it to be intellectually challenging, and we need in any operation everybody's input and ideas. So when you're thinking about some of the things that frustrate you, don't always just bring up the problems. Think about what would be some possible solutions and propose those in a staff meeting or to your superior. Because the best thinking is really how we evolved our services. And so we need everybody engaged in doing that. And it makes work so much more fun and exciting to do a little bit beyond. And don't look at it. It really is the difference between a job that's just the hours or a career in a profession. And the reason we all went into pharmacy was to do more than just manual labor. But it's up to us to make it more than that by being actively engaged in what's going on in our organization and our department. And again, look at the changes as opportunities. Don't look at them as the doom and gloom. How can we use this to pharmacy's advantage? And how can we help our patients? Because remember, we're all going to be patients someday, and many of our family members are patients, and we want the best possible pharmaceutical care for them. And it's up to us to figure out how to do that in each of our organizations and departments.
What has been the greatest piece of advice that's ever been given to you?
I think the whole concept that you can do whatever you put your mind to. When I was looking for a director position, the job in California at Stanford, I wasn't licensed and would mean I needed to take the California boards, and I'd been out of school about 30 years, I think, at that point. Really wish I'd have done that when I came out of school, but I didn't. But I knew that was going to be something I had to do. And when I took the job, I set my mind to doing that. Went back and memorized the top 200 like we did when we were in school. Found there were a lot of Me Too drugs, because at Kansas we had a pretty tight formulary. But I was able to pass the board. So, I mean, you can do anything you put your mind to. And I think that piece of advice, having enough confidence in yourself to figure it out, may take you a while. May not. I was prepared to take it a second time if I had to. But you will get it done. And I think that is the best advice I ever got.
And what would be the greatest piece of advice that you would give to pharmacy professionals?
I think to really view ourselves as the valuable contributor that we truly are, and to do something that I know feels very uncomfortable, but to market ourselves and toot our own horns to those outside of the pharmacy. Because we tend to assume that the nurses and the physicians that we work with, the administrators in our organizations, really understand what we do and the value we bring. And I would challenge you that that's not really true, because we aren't telling our stories and we aren't saying, here's what we do and here's what we could do. And I know that feels a little uncomfortable, but how else are they going to know? We can't just wait to be discovered. And so we need to push those boundaries a little bit, and we need to be willing to do new and innovative things, like do an anticoag clinic or do something else. I mean, having gone through pharmacy school, in my case, no computers, you learn it as you go. You know, I was so happy when I got to Stanford, the internet was coming on board, so I took a class, and then I went back to my office, and I pushed the print button, and it printed, and I'm going, whoa, I can do this. So don't ever be intimidated by things that you can't do. But pharmacy is such a great profession. We have so much knowledge. The public has never needed us more. We need to maximize that. Look for the niches that are unmet medication needs. And the way to do that is talk to your parents or your grandparents about the medications they're taking and the potential frustrations in just getting things filled and understanding it. There are all kinds of niches for pharmacy to help. I get so frustrated every time I get on a phone tree that I would pay somebody to make sure my refills come and et cetera. So get outside of that box, stretch the boundaries, and take us the next steps further. And so that, you know, if you're sitting in my place in several decades, you can talk about what has evolved in your career that you've been part of, because that's going to be the significant impact, the difference that you've made that you're going to feel good about.
Pharmacists are trained very well technically. With regard to leadership skills and some of the soft sciences, communication, being able to develop those relationships, how important are those soft sciences in being successful as a pharmacist and being able to tell our stories and make others aware of what pharmacists can do.
As I reflect on it, I think they are really important. And again, most of us went into science without that as a need. But I think it's so critical that you're able to work effectively with others. And that's your not only your patients, but the other health professionals in a collaborative sort of way. And it's not that complicated. You just have to watch how other successful people do it. We all sit in a lot of meetings today or listen to a lot of lectures. Just watch how the people who get what they want do it, and how the people that turn everybody off, how they do that, and make sure you're not doing the latter. And then look at where to be influential. And so, you know, it's a matter of just opening yourself up to that and not being so pure in the science to not want this, what my staff at Stanford would call touchy-feely, but it's the way in which organizations function. And so you want to be effective and influential, and so you need to just pick up some of those skill sets. But it's very easy to do, and then you will be that much more successful and happier and challenged in your career.
You have a bit of a unique role on a publicly traded company at Omnicell. What is it like to be a member, a corporate board member?
That was is really an interesting experience for me. I kind of had that opportunity as I retired, and I probably would have declined it had I not been retiring because it would have been a conflict of interest. But the corporate world, in some ways, it's like healthcare in that there's a lot of regulations. Being publicly traded, we have to comply with all of the Securities Exchange Commission regulations. I traded narcotic control for that, but it's the same concepts. I happen to chair the governance committee of the board, and so there are certain things we have to do like we had to do in healthcare. And so I make sure we've tested those things because we have to be able to prove that. But the interesting thing is setting the directions for a corporate board and thinking about what needs to happen, because what the board is doing is representing the shareholders of that corporation. And so you've got not only the quarterly earnings, the short term that you've got to make, but you've also got to look strategically and long term. And the interesting thing about the stock market, even before things kind of got way out of control, is if we missed our earnings slightly, we would really be punished with the stock price. And so being able to keep that adjusted appropriately, make money for our shareholders, but also do the kind of investment for the long term and have the kind of relationships, it's a really interesting, different kind of corporation and world. So it's been intellectually very challenging. And again, it's an example of how you'll figure it out as you go. The first agenda that I was sent had M&A on it, and I'm thinking, I have not a clue, but I'm just going to wait and see if I can figure it out. And very clearly it became evident that's mergers and acquisitions. I'd just never done that in the academic world. So it's fun to do, and it's a stretch, and you get outside your comfort zone, but that's how you continue to learn and grow. And you're going to want to do that even in retirement, because you don't want to just sit back. And so I enjoy the corporate world and the kind of fun, different sorts of things as challenges and relationships.
How have your leadership skills helped you be successful as a member on that corporate board?
I think, again, I'm the only pharmacist. And when I first got on, no one else was even a healthcare professional. So building relationships with venture capitalists, for example, that I have not a clue what they do, nor they have a clue what I do, but you build that on a personal level. And it's the same sort of thing. And then being willing to, you know, step up and volunteer for committees and volunteer to chair a committee. And you do that the same way you did in the professional organizations. And so the same skill set of, you know, not making every issue a problem, thinking about where you can make your biggest impact and providing it there, and then being willing to do things that will support and help the company, is just like you did with your organization. So it's the same sorts of skills. It's just how can you best apply those?
Sarah, you've talked about a career as a marathon and not a sprint. In that marathon of your career, how did you know when it was time to make a career change? And what did you do once you had made that change to set yourself up for success?
Well, and I think as a young person, when I went to Kansas, I figured maybe I'd be there, I don't know, 5 years. I was there for 20 years. And I think the key for me was I continued to grow and develop. And had I felt like I was not doing that, I probably would have moved on sooner. But in working with Harold Godwin, he was ASHP board member, he was president, and therefore I got to do a lot of his roles while he was gone. And then he supported me while I did those roles. But I knew at some point I wanted to be a director of pharmacy. That was kind of my long-term goal. I also recognized he was probably not going to leave. And so at that point, I started looking around and saying, where are the positions that I might be interested in? And I took a while because there were several I interviewed for that would have been great positions, but just the lifestyle there didn't feel right. And people had always told me that, you know, it'll eventually feel right. And I'm thinking, well, that's not very scientific, but they were actually very right, because there are the scientific things you look at, but then there's also how are you going to feel living in that area. So I think you know, I think the answer to the question is you know when it's time to leave. Just don't be desperate about it. Take your time, make sure it's the right move, and then do it. And it's going to be different for everyone, because we're all different in what's happening where we're looking. I think the key, again, is don't be a victim. Don't stay someplace if you're unhappy, because you've always got choices. None of them are ever going to be ideal, so there's always going to be trade-offs. But make those as conscious decisions and be in charge of your career, as we talked about earlier on.
Thank you very much for your time today, Sarah.
It's been my pleasure.